I am really humbled to be invited to talk about the greatest mystery of the Christian faith, the mystery of the Holy Trinity.
Pastor Brian Wolfmiller talking about his presentation at the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
This doctrine is not an abstraction, but an incredibly practical, comforting, and wonderful mystery. In fact, the contemplation of the Trinity, the reflecting on it, shouldn't end in speculation, but rather in the joy of worshiping God. And that's what we'll get after when we talk about this, making the case for the Trinity.
You can watch Pastor Brian Wolfmiller live or on demand at the Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, July 24th and Saturday, July 25th. The $135 registration fee includes the ability to watch a live stream and a recording. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385.
Marriage is a social justice issue for children. And if we are not doing marriage, if we're not encouraging men to commit to the women they're making babies with, regardless of their race, our society is doomed.
Giving cross-sex hormones to a patient with gender dysphoria and referring them for plastic surgery to alter their sex organs is the same as giving a patient with anorexia nervosa a strict diet and referring her for stomach stapling.
We should not revert to the old creation as Christians when dealing with race and racism, but let's live within the new creation that God has given as a gift to us through Christ.
And just as any little child crawls into the lap of its father to show where his hurts are or to list his complaints, that's what our Lord invites us to do.
Summer Greek students at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, love listening to Issues Etc. while studying Greek.
There have been a lot of attempts made to find that halfway house between prevailing scientific theory, which says that we and all living things evolved together from a common ancestor. It took billions of years, and we don't know how it actually happened or how it must continue to happen, but it must be true because that's the prevailing theory and the biblical account of creation. We tried to find that halfway house like theistic evolution, and some people are even wary of intelligent design for the same reason. Can we find any compatibility between Christian teaching on the origins of life and prevailing scientific theory? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live this Monday afternoon, July the 6th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking about Christianity and evolution. Christopher Geishan will join us, author of the new book, Is Evolution Compatible with Christianity, here in the first hour of the program. In the second hour, we'll be doing a little open lines with Pastor Peter Bender as a way of concluding our Lutheran catechesis series with him. We'll talk about Luther's small catechism, catechizing your children, taking your questions and your comments. We'll also be giving away copies of Lutheran Catechesis, Catechumen Edition, and Catechist Edition to listeners with the best questions or comments on Luther's Small Catechism and Lutheran Catechesis. You can give us a call, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet, @issuesetc, or we have left space at our Facebook fan page for you to put your question or your comment there on Lutheran Catechesis. Facebook.com/issuesetc. Christopher Geishan joins us to talk about Christianity and evolution. He has a master's degree in science education from Indiana University. He spent more than four decades as a biology, earth science, and English teacher at Concordia Lutheran High School in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and he's author of the new book, Is Evolution Compatible with Christianity? Christopher, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hey there, how are you doing? I guess I can call you Todd, right?
Yes. Absolutely.
It's funny because my brother's name is Todd, so small world.
What are the three pillars of Darwinian evolution?
Well, basically what I'm going to do is I'm going to state the pillar and then talk about each one as we go through. So the first pillar that supports evolution is that life put itself together. Now, technically, Darwin never really explained how life put itself together, you know, the stories of the warm pond and so on. So when you talk to an evolutionist about the origin of life and life putting itself together, they will probably say that it has nothing to do with evolution because Darwin never really talked about origins. And what you need to do is respond to them, well, how come that every chapter on the topic of evolution in a biology book has a section dealing with origins? Well, if it's in the bio books, it's got to be part of the evolution story. So anyway, what you got to understand is that when you talk about origins, evolutionists will use diagrams with arrows in them. And the arrows are what I call magic arrows. And basically, you have an image, and then an arrow, and then another image. And that's supposed to explain how something came to be. And they also use deceptive language to make the impossible sound easy. So anyway, when a cell puts itself together, DNA, which has also been called the code of life, also put itself together. So this pillar is very shabby and it's not very supportive because everybody knows if it's called the code of life, well, every code has a code writer. So again, that life put itself together, that does not support evolution. The second pillar is that there are long time spans. Now, it's very important to know that without billions of years, you cannot make the impossible become possible. So that's why they need the long time spans. But good questions should occur. For example, in my book, I talk about radioactive decay elements, and one of them is found in zircon crystals. Well, as this element decays, it gives off helium. But the question is, if this element is so many millions, hundreds of millions of years old, why is the helium still leaking out? It should be gone by now. Or take carbon-14, or otherwise known as radiocarbon. It's found in coal deposits, in all layers of coal deposits, including the very deep ones, which according to evolutionary timescales should be very old. Why is the carbon-14, which has a relatively short half-life, still being given off and found? It should be gone by now. Well, to make a long story short, that second pillar should be gone by now, but it's not. And the third pillar that supports evolution is that living things change into completely different living things. Usually that means that bacteria became cells, cells became sponges. Those turned around and became fish. Fish became frogs, which became reptiles, and eventually we are on the scene. If you want to make an evolutionist upset, you tell him that he is mutated pond scum. I've actually done that before at science conferences and so on, and they kind of turn purple and say, no, we came from bacteria. Well, if you look at bacteria in a pond, what does it look like? Pond scum. When you say you're mutated pond scum, that doesn't make evolution sound very glorious. And the last point I want to make is that we biblical creationists, we who call ourselves Christian, we have a trinity. Interesting enough, so do the evolutionists. They have life put itself together, they have long time spans, and they have that living things can change into other living things. So that's their trinity.
In what way did Darwin overstep his bounds with his ideas?
Okay, one of his ideas was overpopulation. Now, it's important to know that this does occur. But does it have anything to do with evolution? Not really. Well, then a good question is, why do trees, like apple trees, produce so many apples? Obviously, way more than are needed to replace the tree. Well, it's because living things have to eat. That's why there's an overpopulation. And you'll notice as you go up the biomass pyramid, you know, you go to the plants and then the herbivores and then carnivores. The top-level carnivores, there are very few of them. I guess they don't overpopulate, but the other stuff does. Oh, well, another idea where Darwin overstepped his bounds is the struggle for existence. Now, most people have heard of that. But if evolution is true, then since we struggle for existence, we're just animals. Animals kill each other. So why can't we just to get what we want? After all, we are part of this evolution story, and there's this struggle. Well, to end this point, let's just say that evolutionists ought to follow their own thinking. Evolution should be able to have people think about the moral issues and moral implications of evolution. And finally, the next idea is survival of the fittest. Well, we overstep the bounds here because it's really circular reasoning. Think of a circle. You got top half and bottom half. On the top half, there is, if you survive, then you are fit. And on the bottom half, there is this, if you are fit, then you survive. So again, you have circular reasoning. The problem is, logically, it doesn't work. It's like trying to pull yourself up with your own hand. Now, if our listeners haven't ever tried that, go ahead, sit in a chair and try and pull yourself up just with your own hand. It doesn't work. Another reason is that evolutionists don't really follow what they are talking about because of this, you know, survival of the fittest. How do I know that? Well, because evolutionists almost always have nice green lawns. How come they're not raising weeds like dandelions? Their lawn would be three different colors a year. It'd be green and yellow and white, and then go back to green. Besides, weeds don't need any chemicals. You don't need any fertilizer. You don't need to water it. You don't need to mow it. I mean, how earth-friendly can you get? So, obviously, they don't even follow their own logic or reasoning.
How is variation wrong? Don't variations exist in animals?
Well, of course, Todd, they do. But let's just be specific here and say that variations are really powerless to help evolution. So let's explain to our listeners where variations come from. Variations are simply small, tiny changes in the DNA code. So, for example, you may have a flower with red petals. You change the DNA just a little bit in a few key spots, and you might have orange petals or white petals the next year. Okay, so that's where variations come from. But still, these are harmless variations. They do nothing to help changing an animal into another animal. But then, what do variations do, and how do they fit in to the story of life? Well, basically, all variations do is to adjust an animal group to better fit its environment. Well, how does that work? Okay, let's talk about foxes. You know that there's the Arctic fox, which is white. The Indiana fox, that's where I am right now, you know, it's kind of the reddish fox with the white tip at the tail. And then there's the desert fox, kind of a sandy-colored fur with really long ears. Did Noah have all three of those foxes on the ark? No way. There wouldn't be room for all of the different types of animals, but two of each kind. That's what the Bible says. So after the flood, these two dog-like creatures get off the ark. Some become foxes, and some of those foxes migrate to the north where it's cold and white. Guess what? Their fur becomes thick and white, and their ears become very short because you don't want to lose heat up there. Some of these foxes drift to the south where it's sandy desert. What do they get? Brownish colored fur and big, big ears, which help dissipate excess heat. And the Indiana foxes, well, they stay the same color, what they are. What's interesting is that all of these variations are true, yes, but they're all still foxes. Another thing to know about variation is that you can only change within a range. That's a phrase I came up with when I was teaching biology all those decades. Basically, what it means is that there are solid, immovable lines or limits to change. You can only change so much, and if you change too much, you die. Or at best, you at least live, but you can't have any offspring. You're too weird. Think of all the fruit fly experiments, and you know, they should Google that, fruit fly experiments, what kind of stuff we got. We have some pretty weird looking fruit flies. Some of them have, you know, the big red eyes that flies have. Some of them have striped eyes. Some of them have square eyes and what are called squint eyes. In fact, some of them have no eyes. And that's the kind of breeding we've done in genetics laboratories. These are kind of the varieties of variations that we get in fruit flies. Except the truth is, most of these variations would not survive in nature at all. We have to help them along. In fact, among the variations are what we call mutations, and most of those are harmful. But still, after all these decades of fruit fly breedings, what do we get? They're still fruit flies. We have never changed it to become another life form. So, good question to ask the evolutionist. If we can't do it in the lab, how did nature do it? So again, that answers that question.
Christopher Gation is our guest. We're talking about Christianity and evolution. When we come back, we're going to talk about evolution right and evolution wrong.
The prophecy he gave. Can we sprout our wings like angels? Can we break out of the grind? We're destined to be Darwin's children this time.
You can watch and hear Mark and Molly Hemingway, Robert George, Matt Walsh, Brian Wolfmiller, and Hans Feeney at the 2020 Virtual Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Making the Case is Friday, July 24th and Saturday, July 25th. All paid registrants will have the ability to watch the conference live and on demand. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or give us a call 618-223-8385.
Have you ever wondered if your investments could do more? I mean, a whole lot more? This is Rahema Kavuga, Synod Relations Manager of Lutheran Church Extension Fund. When you invest with us, you not only earn a competitive interest rate, but your investment goes to strengthen Lutheran Church Missouri Synod church workers, congregations, schools, and organizations through low-cost loans and services. To learn more, visit lcef.org/invest101.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I like to think of the deaconess vocation as driven by two things, the love of Christ and the needs of our neighbor.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. James Buescher, Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the vocation of deaconess.
First, the deaconess is moved by the love of Christ, who came not to be served, but to serve. Yet I think we can also see the profound needs around us, broken families, loneliness, despair. Deaconesses help the church to become a true family that manifests the love of Christ in our love for one another, and especially for those in need.
For more information on the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit ctsfw.edu or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Monday, July the 6th, we're talking Christianity and Evolution with Christopher Gation, author of the new book, Is Evolution Compatible with Christianity? You talk about evolution right and evolution wrong. What do you mean by that?
Usually, when I was teaching biology, I would talk about evolution right. And some of the looks of students were quite shocked and surprised, and they'd raise their hand and, Mr. Gation, you're a creationist, aren't you? What do you mean evolution right? And that's when came the teachable moment. Does evolution exist? Well, yes and no. Because when an evolutionist hears a person like me, who's a Christian and Lutheran at that, to talk about evolution right, they kind of look at me and say, wait a minute, you're even a Lutheran. How can you say evolution right? So let's get this term dealt with. Evolution right has been called speciation or microevolution in the past, and it still is today. Think of all the breeds of dogs and cows. They're all still dogs and cows, and never the twain shall meet. So these are some examples of evolution in biology textbooks, and believe me, after teaching for decades out of biology textbooks, I know what they contain. So they contain these things of evolution right in the biology books, and those are scientifically true, like I said, breeds of dogs and breeds of cows. But beware, this is where the evolutionist textbook or your evolution prof, if you're a person going on into college, they will say, oh good, you believe this, therefore evolution's true. Now you're going to believe this, that bacteria become basketball players. Excuse me, remember mutated pond scum? I'm sorry, that doesn't follow. Because in the lab, you can prove evolution right. There's no experiment that proves evolution wrong. And that's where we get the term evolution wrong. Like I said, they can change into other animals and become other things. But the one thing that evolution wrong will never, ever explain is that the creature that gets this new trait, whatever it is, this mutation, has got to know what to do with it. In other words, a behavior has to be evolved. Okay, let me take your listeners on, a scenario where you have an amphibian becoming a reptile. Now, that's what evolution says. Okay, let's grant you that this amphibian, like a salamander, is going to get claws on its toes, like lizards have, get a scaly skin, like lizards have, get more developed lungs, a 3.5-chamber heart, everything that a lizard has. In fact, they even change their egg from a jelly-coated one that must be laid in water to a leathery-shelled egg, like a lizard lays. Okay, oops, it's time to mate. So the mutated salamander mates, and now it's time to lay your eggs. So following salamander behavior, it goes to the lake, lays the eggs in the water, and the mutated baby that's supposed to be born into a lizard dies because it drowns. You cannot put lizard eggs in water. Oop, I guess evolution's done. So again, unless you mutate behavior, you're not going to get evolution to go forward. And so again, that's one of the things that makes it evolution wrong.
Biology books often state or discuss the evidence that supports or purports to support evolution. Can you give us some examples of that evidence and how would you refute them?
Okay, my book goes through several examples, some of which I'll talk about here. One of them is finch beak sizes. Now, most of you have heard about Darwin's finches, and there's a wide variety of finches on the Galapagos Islands. Well, Dr. Peter and Mary Grant did a study on the finches, and one of the traits they studied was the finch beak sizes. So they got a group of finches that eat seeds. Now, the Galapagos has dry years and wet years, kind of cyclical. And during the dry years, the seeds get harder and tougher to crack. Well, you need a bigger pliers, you need a bigger beak. And so the birds, the finches that have smaller beaks, die out and they don't reproduce. Well, guess what? The average size of the beak goes up. And they document it. And yes, that's science. That's good, true. It's provable. It happens. You can see it. But what the biology book does not do is does not tell the students that during the wet years, the smaller beaks come back and the size of the beak on average goes down. So the graph should go up and down, up and down. Cyclical, repeating itself. Now, the reason that biology books do not share this truth is because it does not support evolution wrong. Another example of the textbook evidence is embryo likenesses. And in most of the books I taught for my 40-plus years, the biology books and the ones I taught with were by Miller and Levine. They were the book Biology by Prentice. Now, some of you older adults may have had Prentice Hall. That was the name of the company. But anyway, you may have remembered the embryo evidence for evolution. And you saw Haeckel's embryo sketches. And I can attest, in the early versions of the book that I dealt with and taught from, sure enough, Miller and Levine had Haeckel's embryo sketches saying how embryos all look alike at one stage of the development and then change and become, you know, the baby rabbit or the baby opossum or the baby shark and so on. Even baby humans they had in there. Well, what's interesting is in the most current version, they have a photograph of an embryo opossum. I'm not kidding. It's there in the picture. But the caption of the photo says, you have to be an expert to tell that this is an embryo opossum. Okay, you know, I'll grant you, maybe you do have to be an embryo expert to know that that specific one is an embryo opossum. But in my book, I have a sketch showing what real embryos look like. Embryo fish, embryo frog, embryo lizard, etc. I'm telling you, Todd, A three-year-old can pick out the differences of the embryos. They do not look alike. So I guess they're trying, again, bait and switch, which doesn't work. And the last item of evidence that they sometimes trot out is what's called vestigial organs. What's the definition of a vestigial organ? Well, vestigial means small or shrunken. These are shrunken or small limbs or body parts that are supposed to be no longer in any use, and so it's going away, and this animal is becoming something else, blah, 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 blah. It's important for your listeners to know that in the course of evolution studies and so on in America, from the time Darwin taught till about, let's say, in the 1800s, there was a list of 60, that's 60, vestigial organs in the human body that are leftovers from evolution. Well, guess what? The list is now down to 3. Okay, listeners, how many of you have a tailbone? Of course, all of you, yeah, I'm raising my hand. It's, you know, beneath my waist and my back. I'm sorry, you are using an evolutionary holdover. Why do you think they call it a tailbone? Because when we were monkeys swinging through the trees, we used to have a tail, and it shrunk. To be honest, your tailbone is not useless, and it has a name. It's called a coccyx. This coccyx is useful for muscle attachment. Without it, you cannot stand erect. Well, if this is a vestigial organ and useless, I would like to kick an evolutionist so hard as to break his tailbone. He would not be able to stand upright. It would be very painful. Another one is your appendix. Well, I'm sorry, but your appendix has a vital function when you're young. It acts as an important part of your immune system until the other parts of your body take over for that. And believe it or not, Todd, they actually talk about wiggling your ears. Now, some people can do it and some people can't. Okay, listeners, your Uncle Fred, when he would wiggle his ears, you laughed and thought it was funny. I'm sorry, to the evolutionists, that just means he's lesser evolved. Because animals can twitch their ears. Look at dogs and cats. They can flick their ears about. Horses do that. That's what we have if we can wiggle our ears, a remnant, a leftover of evolution. So when you talk to an evolutionist, kind of wave your hands away and say, you don't know what you're talking about. Vestigial organs show something shrinking and going away or disappearing. Evolution has to be about gaining structures. So why is this a proper evidence for evolution? It's not. It's maybe something changes. Okay, maybe there are some cases where they are shrinking. Okay. But evolution is about gaining, not just shrinking and going away.
Christopher Gieschen is our guest. We're talking about Christianity and evolution on this Monday afternoon. He has a master's degree in science education from Indiana University. We'll be right back. All we are is dust in the wind. Oh. What is God calling you to do? What is the one thing you were born to do? Are you truly doing what you're called to do? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is Callings for Life, God's Plan, Your Purpose. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or learn more about Callings for Life at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Callings for Life, God's Plan, Your Purpose.
Our life together as the church after COVID-19 will bring new challenges. For example, we might be tempted to skip the regular gathering of God's people because we're more comfortable streaming it on Facebook instead. May it not be. Join the Reverend Dr. Mark Wood as he explores this theme in his article for the June-July issue of the Lutheran Witness titled, Gathering Again, It Will Not Be the Same. Subscribe at cph.org/witness, The Lutheran Witness, Interpreting the Contemporary World from a Lutheran Perspective, cph.org/witness.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR20. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about Christianity and Evolution with the author of the new book, Is Evolution Compatible with Christianity, Christopher Geeshan. Christopher, how are facts and the interpretation of facts related to this issue?
Whew. Well, I could devote a whole chapter to this, but just to summarize real quick, a fact is something proven true. Those of you that remember Dragnet, remember Jack Webb? Just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. And facts are indeed important. Now, the difference is interpretation. That is telling us what the facts point to. It's kind of like looking at a bunch of dots and you say, oh, I see this pattern. Other people would say, no, I look at dots and I see a different pattern. So anyway, that's interpretation. Think of a Sherlock Holmes story. And by the way, I use a Sherlock Holmes quote to introduce every chapter in my book. Believe me, I had to look really hard to get a Sherlock Holmes quote that fit my topic on space aliens. So anyway, remember the Holmes and Watson stories. Holmes and Watson look at the same bits of facts, the whole list. Watson said, oh, Holmes, don't you know, it says the butler that did it. And Holmes says, elementary, my dear Watson, it's a little lady down the street. You read the stories, Holmes was right. Both of them had interpretations, but one of them was wrong, and one of them was right. So why is it that both creationists and evolutionists can look at the same set of facts, biological facts even, and have different interpretations? How do these different interpretations come to be? Well, the truth is that everyone has a philosophy or a worldview, and that's what colors the facts. Now, when I was teaching biology, I made this very simple to understand for the students. I had sunglasses of green tinted lenses and blue tinted lenses. I wore the green ones, and I said, oh, all of you are green, therefore you're mutated apes. I put on the blue sunglasses and said, oh, all of you are shaded blue. You are direct creations of an almighty God. And so I took off the glasses and I said, which one's correct? And of course, they, almost all of them, said, well, the blue glasses, because we know it's true. But the point I'm making is that it was the glasses that colored the interpretation or gave the difference in the interpretation. So we must remember that the evolutionist has a philosophy, just like we do, except his is wrong. His philosophy says that naturalism or materialism explains everything. So every single thing that's found in nature has to have a natural cause. Okay, Todd, I know I'm getting kind of long-winded here, but this is critical. We used to say that thunderstorms were like, or lightning was thrown by Zeus, and thunder was, you know, Hermes down in his blacksmith shop hammering away, creating thunder. I'm sorry, that's not where thunder and lightning come from. That's, you know, cumulonimbus clouds and electrical discharge, and we know all that now. That's science. But if you ask for the origin of DNA or the origin of cells or the beginning of life, well, they are looking for a materialistic or a natural explanation. So remember, people, the problem is that creation was a supernatural event. So if you're using naturalism, will you ever get it right? No. Now, I've dealt with evolutionists, and I talk about this in my book. They say that we violate science because we're bringing in God. I'm sorry, but biology has what's called the biogenic law. And biogenic law says life comes only from life. We creationists, especially we biblical ones, do not violate biogenetic law. God is alive, and so again, life comes from life. We don't violate that law. They do. Now, I've dealt with evolutionists who think they can pull one over on me
And they say, oh yeah, well then who made God? Easily to shoot down. Very simple. If God could be made, would he be God? Easily answered, right? So that deals with that, but about facts and interpretation.
We hear a lot about intelligent design. Comment on this idea.
Okay, ID or intelligent design is a very valid idea. Now, there are some who say it's got to be biblical creationism and that's all there is. Now, yes, you guys, I'm agreeing with you, but remember, I'm talking mainly as a scientist here, as a science teacher. And so science has a limit to what it can say. And believe me, science facts will point to a designer. If you go to intelligent design websites, you will find that there are agnostics and atheists who will say that the facts of biology point to a designer. Now, obviously, Bible-believing Christians out there, science will never tell you it's the God of the Bible. It can't. It's not supposed to. It's not designed to do that. What's really interesting, if you read about evolutionists and their statements, Professor Dawkins is one. Professor Dawkins has said that things only look designed, but they're really evolved. Well, excuse me, Professor Dawkins, but the other option is also possible. They only look evolved, but they really were designed. So the sum of all biology, all the science facts that we've got, are better interpreted, and there's that word, interpretation, are better interpreted as in pointing to a designer, and an intelligent one at that. I encourage your listeners to look up biological machines. Go ahead and Google it or YouTube it. YouTube is better. Biological machines, and you're going to get a whole host of wonderfully animated scientific videos. Some of these are very interesting. I used to show them to my bio classes. One of them is a walking motor protein. Yeah, a walking motor protein. Now, obviously, it's got a more scientific name, but just go ahead and YouTube that, walking motor protein, and about anywhere from 7 to 10 videos pop up. I looked at one of the videos, and no kidding, the narrator said it's a machine. Now, watch the video. What do these walking motor proteins do? They move parts of the cell around. Now, most of us have seen animations or even live action, you know, sped up actual photographs and, you know, movies of cells, and they're moving, parts are moving. Maybe you've seen a video where the chromosomes are moving to the center of the cell during the phases of mitosis. What moves the chromosomes? Very simply, walking motor proteins. They literally tow things around in the cell and move them from place to place. Or how about another machine? This one's even more complex, a ribosome. Now, obviously, in your bio books, you see it just as a dot. Go ahead and YouTube ribosome. That is a machine that's incredible. It first of all has to read a strip of nucleic acid called messenger RNA. And then that messenger RNA gets read three bases at a time. And then another RNA called transfer RNA drags an amino acid to the factory. And by the way, they do call it the protein factory. So it drops off the amino acids and eventually you form a protein. And by the way, speaking of circular reasoning and like illogic, in order to open DNA to read the code, you need an enzyme, which is a protein. But in order to make the protein, you have to have the ribosome. And you have to have messenger RNA and you have the other RNAs. So which came first, DNA, RNA, or protein? It's a good chicken or egg question for the evolutionist, and they cannot answer that, by the way. So anyway, getting back to intelligent design, all of these machines I've talked about are actual, true, scientifically parts of a cell. Do you evolve machines? Of course not. You design machines, and you build machines in factories, which are designed. So, Todd, everything in the cell points to design. An intelligent designer is a very valid theory for science.
We'll be talking about fossils and the fossil record in our conversation on Christianity and Evolution with Christopher Geeshan, author of the new book, Is Evolution Compatible with Christianity? Right after the break. Religion or astronomy, Deuteronomy, it all started with the Big Bang. Started with the Big Bang. It all started with the Big Bang.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we'll continue our romp through Romans, Children of the Light. Welcome the week. Forgo judgment, the kingdom of God, and whatever does not proceed from faith is sin. Join me, Pastor Will Wheaton, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study on demand at thewordendures.org and on the Lutheran Public Radio app.
Your church's chrismons are from the 80s. They're made of styrofoam, their glitter is shedding, and they're held together with toothpicks. Now is the perfect time to replace them with Ad Crusman's Christmas in July sale. Participating artists have discounted their products, so stock up on jewelry, crucifixes, art, church banners, music, greeting cards, and more. Discounts range from 10 to 50% off. Visit us at adcrucem.com to take advantage of the sale. That's adcrucem.com.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
Bahama Mama, Ocean Pacific, Paradise Island. Retreat from the heat with a shaved ice snow cone from Tropical Snow in Caseyville, Illinois. It's right across the street from Collinsville High School. Tropical Snow is open weekdays from 1 to 9 and weekends from noon to 9. Premium snow, epic flavors, lots of love. Tropical Snow across the street from Collinsville High School at 2134 South Morrison Avenue in Caseyville.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth, Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're discussing Christianity and Evolution with Christopher Geeshan. He has a master's degree in science education from Indiana University, and he spent more than four decades as a biology, earth science, and English teacher at Concordia Lutheran High School in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's author of the new book, Is Evolution Compatible with Christianity? Let's talk about fossils. They are said to support evolution. Why is there a better way of interpreting these fossils in the fossil record?
Well, fossils are not Grandpa Ralph, you know. Fossils are actually remains or traces of past life. Now, to make one, and this comes straight out of earth science books, and a few biology books may talk about how fossils are formed, but it's mainly an earth science topic. To make a fossil, you need rapid burial. You got to bury it with something. Oh, that's the second thing you need. You need sediments, like sand or mud, something like that. Now, those of you who have ever done a driveway or a sidewalk, you can't just pour the cement and then say, okay, it's concrete. You need water, and the water helps cement things together. And then finally, you need pressure, which helps the cementing process happen. I challenge the evolutionist to give me an event that gives you all four items, all four processes, and that is the flood. There is no other one. Now, most of the time, they will show you the process of fossilization in a diagram, like I've got in my book. And the diagram shows a fish on its side sinking down into the water because it's dead. They next show the fish body being buried by sediments like mud or sand. And then they finally, in the bottom picture, show an evolutionist digging up a fish fossil. The problem is, that is not how to make a fossil. If that were really the case, there would be no fish fossils. They'd all decay and rot away before they actually turn to stone. And besides, How do you slowly bury a Brachiosaurus or a T-Rex, for example? It would take an awfully long time, and by then there would be no bones to fossilize. So we've got to have rapid burial. We've got to have sediments. Now, of course, my students in class will say, but Mr. Geeshan, how did that happen? I mean, we understand the flood, but explain the burying process. And so I had to tell them a quick story. When I was snorkeling in Florida for the very first time in my life, it was great. So time to go back. Well, it was hard because the tide was going out. I had to walk backwards about 40 yards to get back to shore. But anyway, the point of the story, though, Todd, is that as the tide was going out, I'd never felt that before, so I put my hand down. Guess what? I got a handful of sand in about 25 seconds. Wow, the tides move an awful lot of sand very quickly. So please remember, people, during the flood, water covered the whole Earth, entire Earth, except we still had the moon, we still had rotation of the Earth, we still had the tides. 6 hours in, 6 hours out, 6 hours in, 6 hours out. Wouldn't that rapidly bury a T-Rex or a Brachiosaurus, as well as all the millions of other organisms that drowned and died in the flood? Well, of course it would. So please remember, as we study fossils, the only real thing that fossils do is to show us what previous organisms look like. And that's fine. That's valid. That's a scientific study. But remember, evolution says that living things changed into what? Different kinds of living things. So then we should have some animals becoming extinct. Yeah, but remember, they should change over time. Go ahead and Google fossil ginkgo, that's G-I-N-K-O, ginkgo leaves. And then look up real ginkgo leaves. They look exactly the same. Or fossil scorpions. There are fossil scorpions in a substance called amber. They look exactly like the scorpions of today. And the most famous example is the coelacanthus fish. The coelacanthus fish was only known by fossil forms, and it supposedly was extinct for, oh, I'm going to say 250 million years, whatever the date was. Except, guess what? Around the 1930s, 1940s, they found living coelacanthus fish. How did they know it was a coelacanthus? Because it looks almost exactly like the fossil form. Excuse me, Mr. Evolutionist, animals change through time. Oh, that's right, they change through time, except when they don't change through time. So again, evolution does not exist except on paper.
Is theistic evolution a valid compromise? And if not, why?
Okay, Todd, I'm going to have to get into theology here. Now, being a Christian, and like I said, a Lutheran one at that, I had to write this book to include all ways to talk about evolution. And is it compatible with Christianity? Well, the flat-out answer is no, but you'll have to get the book to figure out why. But theistic evolution is where some people try and play the middleman, and they, well, let's try and have it both ways. Basically, theistic evolution is defined as God using evolution to do his creating. I'm sorry, that's not what Genesis says. So what we have to understand is that the theistic evolutionists are a group of people that make nobody happy. The evolutionists don't like them at all, and they denounce them. Why? Because you're bringing God into it. The Christians who are Bible-believing say, nope, can't have it, doesn't exist. Why? Because you're calling God a liar. I am not going to be the one to do that. Now, the theistic evolutionist will say, oh, no, no, we are simply interpreting the Bible differently. Again, there's that word, interpretation. But why do you have to interpret the Bible differently? Oh, that's right, they want science to be true, and evolution is science. And again, we play the game of evolution right or evolution wrong. But they are trying to be scientific, and so that's what they're trying to do, is to merge the two together, and it doesn't work. So it doesn't work scientifically, and it doesn't work theologically. Another reason to denounce this is because you have God working through disease and suffering and pain and death for millions of years to get what he wants. My God isn't like that. The story I used to tell my biology students is, okay, when Jesus calmed the storm, and by the way, I think the version you look up is in Mark. Now watch, it'll be in Matthew. But anyway, you got to find one verse at the end of the miracle, and I'll get to that. So Jesus is sleeping in the boat, and the storm comes up, and the disciples wake him up. What's the matter? Aren't you, we're going to die. Don't you care? And Jesus, if you watch the video of it, it's like, okay, be still. And by the time you get to the L of still, and I know he spoke Aramaic, I don't know Aramaic, but by the time you get to the L of still, you go from cumulonimbus clouds to clear skies. You go from 60-mile-an-hour wind gusts to dead calm. You go from 6-7-foot waves to flat glass sea. And how much you want to bet, Todd, their clothes are dry. Read the next verse. There are translations that say they were terrified. Ah, Jesus! Ah! And I can see Jesus saying, oh, you want me to bring the storm back? I didn't mean to scare you. What manner of man is this who the wind and the waves obey him? I'm sorry, he's God. He's the one who made the wind and the waves. He's Lord of all. And so when God spoke, things came into being instantly. How about this? Imagine you can get the DVD on creation. I know they don't have DVDs anymore, but okay, I'm old school. Get the DVD on creation and get the chapter on day 5. That's when birds were made. Okay, so you play that section, chapter 5, and you have this majestic view of the clouds, and oh, the music is playing, and you sweep down to the forest, and you know, the violins, da, 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 oh, everything's so great. The look up, and the camera pans up to the birds. You do not ever see birds forming, Todd. You see birds instantly flying, swimming, hopping on the ground, eating seeds, whatever they're doing. They were made instantly. But look at the creation of man and woman, Todd. God took time to make man in his image. I don't know about you, but that says, it's a huge reason why we are not animals. We are made to be different from animals. Because honestly, Todd, if theistic evolution is true, what's sin? Sin is God's fault. He allowed it to happen. Yep, see? So, I'm sorry, that's not what sin is. Sin is our fault. So, that's the point I want to make, though, Todd, is that theistic evolution has no place in the Christian. Now, am I going to say that if you believe in evolution, you're going to hell? I can't say that. I'm not going to do that. But what it does do is it ruins your testimony, it weakens your faith, and it makes you side with the devil's playground. And I'm not going to do that.
What are some stories that you have associated with your journey on this issue?
Some of the stories that I've already mentioned, you've heard. And some of the stories, again, you'll have to buy my book and find them. But three of them that come to mind to me. First one has to deal with astronomy. I had to take the subject of astronomy as part of my life science master's degree. Astronomy professor at the university was very good. I'm not kidding, Todd. Not one whisper of evolution. He would explain the orbits of planets. He would explain the characteristics of the moons that orbit planets. He would explain the stars, why they're different colors, where they're located. And I mean, just on and on. It was an awesome class. And I thought it was great because there was not one hint of evolution. Oh, I was very comfortable. Until about a week before finals, there was a hand in the back of the room. And Dr. Jones, his name was not Jones, but Dr. Jones, where did the solar system come from? He immediately stopped. His demeanor changed. He sat down on the desk and crossed his legs. And then he said, this is what actually happened. I'm telling you, Todd, when I heard that phrase, I kind of snookered down in my seat and I went, gotcha. he told his tale of the planetesimals, which are the little chunks of rock that miraculously put themselves together into forming the planets, and they just happened to be orbiting the star, which had the greatest collection of chunks of rock, which then were so great powerful forces turned into the sun, blah, 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 blah. Well, after he was done, I rose my hand and I said, Dr. Jones, how do you know that's what actually happened? Were you actually there? Honestly, I thought I would be chewed out for asking an embarrassing question, for making the prof look stupid. But it was weird because there were about 100 kids in the classroom with me. 99 of them burst out laughing. And you should have seen the prof's face. He looked like a deer in headlights. I could imagine what's going on in his head. Oh my, I said actually, and that's a good question with actually, because science demands an observer and nobody was there. Oops. So when the laughter died down, he said, well, that is what astronomers believe. Do you get that? He changed actually happened to a statement of faith. Now it's true, I'm not saying biblical faith, I'm not saying that. But he took it from the realm of actually happened fact into believe, an item of faith, which they have not much evidence for, in fact, hardly any. So imagine, Todd, if I had never said anything, and again, I told my students this, what if I had kept my mouth shut? 99 people in that room would have thought that this is what actually happened, except me. But because I made him deal with the actually happened, he changed it into believe, and now maybe 50 people are believing it, or 40, or who knows. But I plant the seed of doubt. So that's why your listeners have to get my book, so that they can become educated how to shoot down evolution. Another story is at a science conference for non-public school teachers. I gave a presentation. After everyone left, I'm packing up my stuff, and I'm starting to walk out, and there are these two guys sitting there looking like they've been sucking on lemons all day. They had the sourest, most disgusted look on their face. So I walked up to them and I said, can I help you, gentlemen? And the one guy sneered at me and said, that's just so preposterous. How can you make light without the sun? You know, creation. God said, let there be light, and the sun wasn't around yet. So that's what he's referring to. He's mocking me for my belief, which is, of course, based on fact. So, folks, I'm telling you, I still believe God inspires. I knew exactly, suddenly, boom, in my head, I knew what to do. I walked over to the wall, I turned off the lights, I turned on the lights, and I walked back to them and said, we make light without the sun all the time. Why can't God? Oh, I wish I had a video of their faces. The sneers dissolved into looks of astonishment. I'm not kidding, their jaws dropped. And finally, the guy said, I never thought of that. It was all I could do from grabbing their shirt sleeves and yell at them, start thinking. My final story has to do with when I was at a science conference of a public nature. And so we're all sitting there waiting for the guy to start. And I'm conversing with my neighbor. He finds out that I'm a creationist and a biblical one at that. He sneers at me, you better watch out. I've got my master's degree in biology. Now, instead of shriveling up and blowing away like all the other creationists he's bumped into, I went, oh, good. I've been wanting to find one of you guys for a long time. Again, deer in headlights. He shrunk back in his seat and wasn't ready for one. And I said, would you please tell me how DNA put itself together without the hand of God? I'm pausing for a long time because you are hearing his answer, or should I say not answer. Well, the guy starts talking in the front, and so I wrote the evolutionist a note, and I said, dear sir, please tell me how DNA put itself together. And if you can't do that, my side is right and your side is wrong. Now, for the price in those days of a postage stamp for 10 cents, he could have sent me a 5-page paper shooting down my idea and showing how DNA, with scientifically proven studies, show DNA can randomly put itself together and make an exact code, can do that. Well, it's been over 30 years, and I'm still waiting for his answer. So those are just some of the stories I share, and others are in my book.
Christopher Geishan has a master's degree in science education from Indiana University. He spent more than four decades as a biology, earth science, and English teacher at Concordia Lutheran High School in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and he's author of the new book, Is Evolution Compatible with Christianity? You can learn more about how to schedule Christopher Geishan to speak at your church or school and how to purchase his book, Is Evolution Compatible with Christianity? At our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Christopher, thanks.
Thanks, Todd. It was good to talk to you.
Next hour, Pastor Peter Bender will respond to your questions and comments on Luther's Small Catechism and Lutheran Catechesis. It's an opportunity for you to win Lutheran Catechesis, Catechist, and Catechumen editions. I'm Todd Wilkin. Stay with us.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.